So I think the big failure has actually been how slow competition policy has been to catch up with the change in the way industries are made up and these dominant companies. That is now changing in the EU, in the UK, in the US, even in China, with a very different legal framework. There have been measures to try to limit the power of big digital companies and make it more possible for new entrants to come in.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Matilda Festing, and today I'm joined by Diane Coyle. This is a podcast in our MPS series, where you will meet many lecturers who visited the MPS seminar in Oslo in October 2022. Diane Coyle is a professor of public policy at the University of Cambridge. Diane co-directs the Bennett Institute, where she heads research under the themes of progress and productivity. Her new book, Cogs and Monsters, looks at how economics needs to change, while her previous book, Markets, State and People, Economics for Public Policy, examines how societies decide, reach decisions about to use the use and allocation of economic resources. We will talk about industrial policies, failures and how to make good decisions. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you for inviting me on. It's a great pleasure.
We can start with your latest book. It's called Cogs and Monsters, What Economics Is and What It Should Be. And first, what are cogs and monsters?
Well, I hope you like the title.
I do.
The cogs refer to us, really. It's a reference to what's called the methodological individualism of economics, where you consider the decisions that people take independent of each other rather than the social influences. And the monsters are all of those areas of the economy that we don't understand as well as we ought to, perhaps because of the way the economy is changing. So all of those, what are sometimes called wicked problems out there. How do we bring about competition in digital markets? What to do about globalization unraveling? What are the economics of climate change? So all of those big, scary problems, like the monsters on unexplored areas of ancient maps.
Mm. And that means, of course, that it's not enough with only cogs deciding, because there's so many things, other things that are coming into play when you have these monsters coming up.
The monsters are going to win if you're acting as cogs. That's the trouble.
Yeah. Then we'll have to just also go on to describe how economics today, how that works really, and how it differs from the past, because we could probably agree that if the past is long time ago, things were simpler then, and it's more complicated, but it's more than that.
The big change when you look at what's happened to the economy in the past, I don't know, 10 or 20 or 40 years, is digital technology, which has absolutely transformed the way that we lead our lives as consumers and employees, or running our own businesses, the way that business models operate. And it's affected everything. It's created globalization because it's possible to have supply chains spanning the entire world when you can do the communication that digital has provided. We spend hours and hours a day online. We shop online. We use all kinds of online services. And companies have changed their business models, or at least some companies have, and others less so. And the ones that have are proving themselves to be more and more successful. So in a nutshell, it's digital transformation. And in a way, you could say lots of the way that we thought about the economy hasn't changed very much. There are some fantastic insights always in economics. But I think there are three things that I'd pick out as causing economics itself to need to change. One is that the economy now, or the value created in the economy now, is largely intangible. And you can see that in the fact that the stock market value of big companies is much, much larger than the tangible assets that they have. It's all about the intangibles, which is everything from brand value and goodwill to what's called organizational capital. How well do they run their processes? So it's the intangibility, and that makes it much harder to think about some of the, you know, some of the ways we think about economic growth or distribution. A second big change is the extent of increasing returns to scale. It's always been the case that scale matters. If you want to build aircraft, then you've got to make huge investments, and there are scale economies. But those scale economies have become quite pervasive now, because in digital businesses, it's almost all fixed cost and marginal costs are very low or even zero. And so these scale economies are everywhere. And basic economic theory tells us that you analyze that kind of economy in a different way than a constant returns to scale, perfect competition economy. But the textbooks still take the simple one as the benchmark. Mm. And we need to flip that around. Mm. And then related to that is the increasing concentration that we've seen in lots of markets, in lots of countries, where some companies are coming to dominate their markets.
Monopolies are almost.
Exactly. And how do you bring about contestability in those markets is a real challenge. So that's at least three ways where we need to think about economics in a different way. So that's quite a long answer. Sorry.
No, it's fine. But and what you're actually saying is that economics in all these senses, in a way, is circling around some problem that I would say have to do with it has to do with size and concentration in many ways, because of all these things that you said are the reasons that economics is different from earlier. Don't have a small player, because the small player would be eaten by the larger one, or it won't even have the possibility to start because the entrance level will be so high.
That's right. And of course, there are still small players, restaurants and hairdressers and people renting out accommodation. But increasingly, they are small players on big digital platforms because that's how they get market access.
But also thinking about those, you have, restaurants maybe, but hairdressers, there's something, how would you would describe that one? It's cutters. That's, or you could go online and you can book and you can cut and you don't have to and you can just go in and it's chain. So they try to get many hairdressers as possible into the same brand and doing more and more, bigger, and then going maybe in other countries as well.
Yes, so that's right. It's this this problem of concentration, really.
Yeah, and then why can't then mainstream economics handle today's economic challenges if we agree that they are in this area you have just described? And how do you describe mainstream economics and its deficiencies, and that those things go together? So when we think about how to, for instance, steer this, make rules, make policies for them to function, how would that be different, and what is the problem?
Well, I think economics could offer us the tools to think about the economy, this new economy of digital and increasing concentration. But it's not the habit of mind that many economists have got, as partly because of the way the textbooks still teach economics. They teach a much simpler world, I suppose. So taking the economic theory seriously that does address increasing returns to scale and concentration and making that the default way of thinking. So I have a lot of expertise in competition policy, and there the example is you do the analysis in terms of platforms and what are called in the jargon two-sided markets, which are these digital platforms, rather than conventional economic models. So we've got those tools, they just need using, and that's one of the issues. There are two others that I address in the book. One is about needing to acknowledge that economic efficiency does actually embed some values. It's not value-free. And you'll often hear economists saying, we just do the analysis, we're all about the evidence, we get compared to plumbers or to dentists. So the idea is that there's a practical problem, and we're the people who can come in, look at the numbers and tell you what the solution is. And that obscures the fact that actually economic efficiency itself is a certain kind of value. And we've got this concept of efficiency that says things are better if you can make one person worse off and nobody else.
Yes.
One person better off and nobody else worse off.
Yes.
Pareto efficiency. But that means you rule out talking about distribution. So there are values embedded there. And I think we ought to be more honest. An example would be talking about quantitative easing. Mm-hmm. And it took a long time for central banks to acknowledge that that had big distributional consequences in favour of people who were well off and held lots of financial assets. And their argument is, if they hadn't done that, unemployment would have been much worse. There'd have been a worse recession after the financial crisis. Certainly true. But I think not acknowledging that there were distributional effects was a policy failure and led to some of the problems that we've seen emerging in many countries. And then finally, I talk about the social makeup of the profession. Largely male, largely well-off, largely white. And for any discipline to be so unrepresentative would be a problem. But when you're a social science, I think it's a particular problem. Mm. And a social science with lots of influence on policy. Because that lack of diversity of experience means you're not necessarily asking all the right questions or understanding different people's perspectives on life. And so for a very powerful discipline, I don't think that's adequate.
And also, you mentioned something in here, and I came to think about that when you talk about economic scale, you talk about the digital economy and about the value of being large companies, but also the intangible values. How does that go with employment policies and unemployment? Because usually you would think about larger businesses employing a lot of people, having work for all of them and so forth. But this economy that you are describing that's surfacing and that's already a reality now, it doesn't necessarily mean that you employ a lot of people.
It doesn't necessarily. And the ratio of employees to both physical and intangible capital in the most profitable companies is lower than in big companies in the past. Employment has been expanding in digital areas. So the sort of raw fear that automation is going to eat the jobs, I think, has not been proven. But a bigger problem is about the skills that are being sucked up by those big companies. And they pay better than smaller companies that are not doing so well. And so in the very unequal distribution of incomes that we see now, it's not a difference across professions, it's a difference within sectors of the economy. Mm. So if you work for a big company, you'll get really well paid. For a small company in the same line of business, not so much. Mm. And that gap has been growing within industries. And so there's something about these big companies, they've got all the intangible assets, the capabilities, they've got the domination in the markets, and they've got all the skilled people as well. Mm. So they're sort of cementing their position and making it ever harder for others to catch up with them.
Hmm. And then the next question, of course, will be when we ought to do something about this. And what are the typical failures, if you think of today's industrial policies, and what's being done in order to amend problems, in order to make these things function better? And it necessarily, they are failures, so I ask about them first.
So I think the big failure has actually been how slow competition policy has been to catch up with the change in the way industries are made up and these dominant companies. That is now changing in the EU, in the UK, in the US, even in China, with a very different legal framework. There have been measures to try to limit the power of big digital companies and make it more possible for new entrants to come in. I think we don't yet know if that's succeeding or not, but that effort is going on. But I would say that was one of the bigger failures. The other really challenging question, and particularly when you've got new technologies on the horizon, is what's the role of the government in incentivizing the investment that's needed in those technologies? And thinking about the role of technical standards to create a big market, thinking about at what level do you want competition and at what level do you want standards that everybody adheres to. An old example is Betamax versus VHS of competing technologies, and the VHS tapes won out. Mm. This will not mean anything to younger listeners, so you've got to be a certain age to understand.
Well, it's something physical, yes.
So we've had these technology battles in the past. And on the one hand, that competition means you might get a better technology resulting from it. On the other hand, there's something a bit wasteful about that. The market would have grown faster if you'd had a standard that created a level playing field from the beginning. So that's a difficult judgment that governments need to think about. But setting standards can be really powerful. And the great example there was setting technical standards for mobile telephony by the EU in the early days, which created a huge global market for mobile phones. And because the standard was the same everywhere, the economies of scale made it much cheaper for everybody. And that was a virtuous circle. So mobile telephony grew very quickly. So that kind of policy is hard. And, you know, it requires a lot of technical expertise. But I think, although it's hard, it's also quite essential to do it because we're looking at some big technology transformations ahead of us. 6G in communications, but energy technologies, electric vehicles, possibly data standards because we want to make much more use of data in society. So in all of these areas, we need some kind of industrial policy framework that de-risks the investment for the private sector. But there's some quite difficult policy judgments involved.
Yeah, so I what I get now is that you say that, of course, it is very difficult for policymakers to try to find the right balance and to introduce the rules and the level play field when it's time to do that. Because yes. I guess in the beginning, you would like entrepreneurs and innovation to happen and you like to different things to be tested out. But then at some point, you also see that, well, we need now to do this in order to get, as you explained with the mobile telephones, is that correctly perceived?
That's exactly right. And of course, government's got it wrong a lot of times in the past. And that's why in the 1970s, industrial policy got such a bad reputation among politicians. And so there has been a stepping back from the idea of active industrial policies since then. But it's I think it's essential to revisit them in the light of this technological transformation that's going on. We can't not have them. We just have to try to make them work better.
Yeah, because let's then talk about this, because as you just said, it might be looked at as a pendulum going from something that's extremely bad, the industrial policies of the 1970s, and then on the other side, people will say that what happened in the 80s, 90s was the other way around, and it's we are even maybe in that direction, have been there for quite a long time. But now, with, for instance, as you said, when we have significant changes going about digital things, but also like green transformation and large infrastructure, because digital economy is also about infrastructure. It was, I mean, having the internet working, you need infrastructure. And how should government think about these kinds of large projects and in investments in order not to do like they did in the 1970s?
Well, I think the key is actually thinking about it. Rather than pretending that there is nothing to be done. Because whatever governments decide to do, whether it's to take action or not take action, that's going to have consequences. And so you could decide to take action in ways that will speed up the technological transition that you want to see, speed up the switch to clean energy, for example. And you might make some mistakes, but there are some principles that would help you avoid those mistakes. And you can focus on private sector investments with some obvious tools. So having an effective competition policy, using public procurement to have open competitions, making sure that export markets are working so there's competition from overseas. All of these help prevent the old kinds of mistakes. But if a government is not doing any of that, then that means that somebody else is going to develop the new technologies. And I think nobody would want to give up the role for their country, their businesses, their employees in these areas of economic growth.
Because you are talking about some criteria that should be met, and probably some of them you just said here, but if you use those criteria that you think are important in these measures, do you have examples of well-performed public investment projects that you could give us, and why do you consider them to be successful?
I suppose my examples are mainly UK ones because I know that much better. In a way, one of the most successful ever was a very old example. And it's the building of the London sewers in 1859 onwards by somebody called Joseph Bazalgette, who was chief engineer at the time. 1859 was a year when it was a hot summer and there was so much sewage in the river that it was called the Great Stink. And the House of Commons had to close down for a while because it smelt too bad. It's right on the river. And Parliament commissioned Joseph Bazalgette to build a sewage system for London. And he built 150 years worth of capacity because we're only just expanding it now.
Wow.
It would never have passed a cost-benefit analysis. He must have spent, I don't know, 250 or 300 billion pounds in today's money building all of this excess capacity. But what a far-sighted investment project that turned out to be. And if you think about it, we're still using an awful lot of Victorian infrastructure. So they had a very long-term perspective and delivered returns for their country for more than 100 years. So that's a very successful example. I'm sure they had failures too. More recently, we've had some really great examples of big infrastructure projects, new tube lines, new rail lines that were built on time, to budget, run effectively, deliver great services. And there are lots of mistakes as well. And there's no science about how you make sure these big projects are the ones that work out. And one of the things I'm working on now is how do you think about policies that themselves can help ensure that your big projects are more successful? How do you think about it like a financial portfolio? There are correlations. How do you make the correlations work to give you a higher rate of return? And so if you're building some part of the new transport network, what else do you need to invest in alongside that to make sure that it's delivers an effective economic return, as well as all the usual project management things that sometimes get forgotten?
Yes, and if I can just jump in and say that big infrastructure project that might be looked upon as maybe a failure would be all the housing that's built in China with nobody living in them. That must be at some point a policy decision, at least at this time today. We are October 2022. I don't know what's going to be in those buildings in 10 years' time, but that will then be something that you invest in and you're not thinking about all the other things around that needs to be in place in order to have people living there.
Yes, although it's also part of a macroeconomic policy mistake in China to have overinvested for so long. And when you do that, the returns on the investment are bound to reduce. So they've had overinvestment and underconsumption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in England, as you were talking about, I mean, if you build something like another metro line or something like that, you do that because you've thought about all the things that's going to happen along this line and why you need it and what are the possibilities that you are creating by doing it.
And also think about the network effects, because you shouldn't ever think of one piece of transport infrastructure in isolation. You need to think about how does it help expand the network, and you'll get increasing returns again if you do that successfully.
Mm. Now we are going on to a microeconomic level and try to see if there's any answers to the right mix. I probably isn't, but there might be some things that are important to consider, and that's the mix between the state and the market. What should be public and what should be private investments, or at least in operations also? And if there's no right mix, what at least are the things that we should think about when we are considering this interface between public and private sector?
It's a great question. And the message from my previous book, Markets, State and People, is that there's no right answer for every country for all time. It does depend on the history and geography of a place, the culture and political choices that the citizens make, and also the way technology changes. But there are some principles, I think. And one point I really would like to make is that they're not opposites. They're not good in competition with each other. We need both. We need a healthy, thriving market economy, and that needs an effective state to deliver infrastructure and public goods. And the markets and states often fail in the same kinds of contexts because of inherent challenges, such as asymmetric information. Some people know things, it's difficult to monitor what's going on. Or you've got these increasing returns that give you a natural monopoly in a market where the efficient scale of operating in the market is just one firm? And how do you regulate it effectively? So these are challenging issues. And the other part of it is the importance of social norms, because we're not cogs, and the way that we decide to behave, whether we're a high trust economy, as Norway and other Scandinavian economies are, that's going to make it easier for the state and the market to deliver effectively than being a low trust economy, which many low income economies are. Mm. So all of these things interact together. And you know, I think if you keep your mind on straightforward principles, that you need them all, you figure out how they mutually reinforce each other rather than competing with each other, and you have some basic policy principles of competition wherever that's possible, transparent regulation where competition isn't possible, and so on. Mm. So it's easy to state, very hard to do in practice.
Yeah, exactly. If you could reflect a little on, let's say that you have a public sector domain, something that you are doing publicly, and in well, you've done that for and it could be in any country really. But then you would like to consider maybe it's better to make this go on to the private sector now, because it might be. You have a thought that this might be better. What are the things that you should think about in doing a transition from now, we have, as I said, from public to private? It could be the other way around as well, but what are your thoughts?
Well, we've had a lot of experience in the UK of privatizing, and I think there are some quite clear lessons from that. One of them is about what's the boundary between what the state, the public sector should do and the private sector, and to what extent that does that depend on how easily you can monitor what the private sector contractors are doing. In when I'm teaching students, I ask them about healthcare. We've got a national health service, so it's almost all publicly provided in the UK, and people are very emotionally attached to it. So I say to my students, is it okay for hospitals to buy from the private sector their stationery? Yes.
Yes.
Their bandages. Yes. So what about their cleaning? And they all say yes. And I say, well, no, because you can't tell from looking if the cleaning is effective. It's really hard to monitor. And since that has been contracted out to private suppliers, the rate of infections in hospitals has rocketed. So not the cleaners. But what about varicose vein operations? And they all say, oh, no, no, all the operations should be done by the health service. Actually, they're really straightforward now because technology has changed and it's really easy to monitor how well they're done. So why would you not contract out? So I think of it...
Are you tricking your students, really?
So that's one set of criteria to use about thinking about the boundary. And what else? Sorry, I've gone blank on the other one.
No, but that is how you say you have a public service, like we also have in Norway, health service, and probably the same answers will be applicable here. I'm not exactly sure if all of them could be, but at least the stationery, the bandages, yes, of course. But then, as you said, technology also counts here. But
Well, that's reminded me, technology is the other thing. That changes the possibilities for competition. We had fixed line telephone networks. And because of the scale of the investment needed, that's a natural monopoly. They're most efficiently provided by one company. But mobile telephony made it possible for many more entrants to come into the market. So technology changed the possibilities there. Mm. And that was fine for the private sector to step in and provide those.
Mm. Okay, so, well, as you're saying, the answers might differ. And sometimes you also now explain that the answers might be surprising, as you just explained, at least to your students.
It's always good to try and surprise your students.
Yes, it's good. They won't fall asleep then if you do that. So then there's another thing. It's a term we also use here in Norway, and I'm curious to know what your views are on new public management and also how you defined it. It's the abbreviation is NPM, but new public management. What is it? What is it, and what are your thoughts?
It emerged from the idea that you can apply economic analysis to government, the public choice revolution, as it was called. And that's obviously very interesting and true. You can analyze what politicians do and what officials do through the lens of economic incentives. This got developed in the 1990s in the UK into new public management, which was the more widespread introduction of private sector management techniques into the public sector in the form usually of target setting. And the idea was that because there was no competition for public services, there needed to be some other mechanism to get people to improve their efforts and be more efficient and productive. The trouble with doing it through targets is that people deliver to the targets, and unless you specify them really carefully, that's not necessarily what you actually want to achieve. And the problems re-emerged in AI, actually, because trying to program algorithms requires specifying a target. And so the AI systems aren't necessarily delivering in the way that new public management didn't necessarily deliver. There are lots of examples in the literature now of things like if you set a target for ambulance response times, then there's a peak at exactly what the target is, but it doesn't necessarily mean that people get treated faster, which is what the outcome that you actually want. So they're quite distorting, and the framework has changed a bit towards contestability in public sector services, where you're trying to create competition between different bits of the public service. For example, giving people a choice between different hospitals that they might go to and attaching flows of money to patients to try to mimic private sector competition in the public sector. That does show some signs of being effective, at least in the UK, where people contrast the NHS in England, which has that system, with the NHS in Wales and Scotland, which don't have it. So I think the big problem with NPM is actually what it assumes about people working in the public service, because it, while acknowledging that they have economic incentives, ignored the fact that they have different kinds of motivations as well. And the intrinsic motivation of public service is actually really important to making it effective. And that, I think, has got overlooked and damaged by the whole new public management period.
What shall we do instead?
Well, that's a good question. And we can't wind the clock back. We've got to where we have. I think the contestability experiments have, on the whole, proven that's not a bad way to go, and people like to have some choice. But I don't have a simple answer to that, I'm afraid. I think it depends which bit of the public sector you're talking about.
But it's, as you said, important then to take into account that they are different motivations and different ways of seeing how you should work and why you choose to work in the public sector and what the mission of the public sector would be at any point in any kind of service. And that has to be taken into account, not only the money transfer or a single goal that's not well specified.
I suppose in a way we've got quite unbalanced that many private sector companies don't have a good sense of purpose, and they have become quite narrowly focused on profits and short-term share price movements. And people in the public service have seen their pay fall much further behind than it used to be, and their intrinsic motivation not being recognised. Somehow we need some kind of rebalancing there. I agree, yes.
Good. Well, it's not important that we agree, but it's interesting because new public management is something that we have been talking about here in Norway as well. But then what are your best advice to policymakers when they shall attempt to engage in reforms, and how should they evaluate? And that's an important thing, reforms when they have been implemented, because our experience here in Norway is that quite often you hear nice speeches about, oh, this is what we're going to do here. We have all the money here. We are going into this. But then afterwards, you're not really sure what happened and what came out of it. So what are your thoughts?
Well, you underline a very important point, which is that there should be some evaluation. And at least in my country, there isn't very much in the policy world. Academics do quite a lot of policy evaluation, but that's slow and doesn't feed back quickly enough for politicians to change their decisions. What we really need is a kind of political environment that makes it possible to try things, and then if they don't work, acknowledge that and do something different. That's become very hard. You know, we've got these polarized societies in many countries and a kind of culture of politicians not being allowed to change their minds, or they're accused of U-turns or hypocrisy or something. But if something isn't working, we would want them to change their mind, surely. And we've had this great example this week, this past week or so in the UK of a politician announcing a very dramatic policy because it seemed a politically sensible thing to do, and then it went very badly wrong. And they were forced to backtrack on that very quickly. But if it hadn't gone quite so badly wrong, they'd have stuck with it. And it would have been a mistake. So I don't know how you fix that culture. It's linked to the kind of media we have and the kind of partisan politics that we find ourselves in at the moment. But having evaluation and having the evidence, being able to learn from what happens and implement that in policy is a really big challenge. And some of the Asian economies have generally managed that better because they've got institutions, ministries or sovereign wealth funds, which are somewhat outside day-to-day politics, and they can make long-term decisions, and it's not particularly embarrassing for them to change course if they learn something from an evaluation.
Yeah, I hear some words say embarrassing. I hear mistakes. I hear maybe disappointment. All these words we use for things that are not really pleasant. So if you avoid evaluation and to evaluate things in order to try to not experience those things, that might also come into play.
Indeed, yes. So it puts a spotlight on the sort of institutional framework that sits alongside the politics, the day-to-day politics.
So that becomes a normal thing to do, and people get used to things being, okay, it's even better that you said this is not working and we are happy because that's the truth, instead of saying, hiding it and saying, oh, it's all fine.
That would be great. It may sound like a naive dream at the moment.
Well, then finally you have a quote, not from 1859, was that the series in London, but I guess from about the Second World War or something like that, that you chose to include in at the end of your book, Markets, State and People. And that is a quote from Keynes, the economist. There's nothing a government hates more than to be well informed, for that makes the process of arriving at decisions much more complicated and difficult. And then I have to ask you, is it better not to inform them or to let them struggle?
Well, I would always say it's better to try and inform them. Whether you can make them listen or not is another matter. And I suppose this is the real conundrum if you're interested in public policy. You've got to acknowledge that it isn't just an analysis of facts and data. It's something that's happening in a political context. You often hear economists say, well, we know how to reform the pension system, or we know how to reform the welfare state, if only the politicians would do it. And my response to that would be, if the politicians can't do it, then you've got your analysis wrong. That's part of your reality that you've got to include.
Wow, that's a good answer. And finally, Diane, before I let you go, of course, we have mentioned your two books, Cogs and Monsters, and the other one, Markets, States and People. But do you have any other book recommendations, or if it could even be podcasts or things for people to listen to if they're interested in what we've just been talking about?
So the things that I listen to are Econ Talker and More or Less, BBC programme More or Less. So anybody interested in economics would do well with either of those. There are some very nice podcasts around. I'm keen on one called The Rest is History at the moment.
Me too.
So I often listen to that. I'm not a great one for watching TV, so I think I'll stick to the podcast recommendations.
Very good. And I'll have to say to the listeners, The Rest is History is not about these things that we have been talking about, but you learn a great many other things.
About a very wide range of other things.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining me today, Diane.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And if you like Liberal Haltime, rate us and recommend us, or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or the email of my colleague, eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita is available on our homepage. Thanks for listening and welcome back. Liberal Halvtime.
podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Moderne medier.